Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Jack Derwin and I'm Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today we're very excited to host a panel discussion titled Biden's Antitrust Agenda, Mission Creep or Mission Achieved? Joining us today is a stellar panel of antitrust experts. In the interest of time, I'll keep these intros very brief, but you can view their full bios at fedsoc.org. Elise Dorsey is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Kirkland & Ellis LLP. Previously, Elise served as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General in the U.S. Department of Justice's Antitrust Division and as attorney advisor to FTC Commissioner Noah Phillips. Amanda Lewis is a partner at Cuneo Gilbert and DeLuca LLP and has held a number of roles in the FTC's Bureau of Competition, including counsel detailee to the Antitrust Subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee. David J. Shaw is a partner in Morrison & Foerster's Global Antitrust Law Practice Group. Before joining his firm, David was the Deputy Chief of Staff and Counsel to the Assistant Attorney General in the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice. And our moderator today, Jonathan Wolfson, is the Chief Legal Officer and Policy Director at the Cicero Institute. Before joining Cicero, Jonathan led the Policy Office at the U.S. Department of Labor, among other roles. After discussion between our panelists, we'll go to audience Q&A. So please enter any questions into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. And finally, I'll note that as always, all expressions of opinion on today's program are those of the speakers joining us. With that, Jonathan, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Jack, and thank you all for joining us today. I'm really excited to get to moderate this panel with three really knowledgeable experts on these topics, and we're going to have an interesting discussion. I'm not going to take very much time other than to give you a quick run of show that we're going to have each of the speakers talk for a few minutes about kind of an overview of what they see as some of the key issues in the Biden administration's decisions so far in the antitrust space. We will then follow that with some specific questions to each of the panelists. And at the end, we'll have some time for Q&A. And as Jack said, please put those in the Q&A tab in Zoom, and we will try to get to as many of those as we can at the end. So with that, I will turn it over to David Shaw to make some introductory remarks.
Well, thanks, Jonathan and Jack. And good afternoon. Happy to be on this panel. You know, I've known Jonathan for almost 25 years. I have the privilege of working with Elise at DOJ. And I've enjoyed getting to know Amanda over the course of preparing for this. And so for my introductory remarks, I'm going to sort of give an overview of the DOJ Antitrust Division in the Biden administration. And I'll address sort of the rhetoric, the policy, and the civil and criminal enforcement we've seen so far. But let me start with just giving a bottom line assessment, which is we're still pretty early into the Biden administration's impact on the antitrust division. But the signal certainly suggests that we're on the cusp of some significant change. So we are early days. Biden may have taken office 18 months ago, but he only appointed and had his head of the antitrust division, Jonathan Kanter, confirmed as the Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust in November of 2021. And moreover, Kanter was the first political appointee to show up in the antitrust division. Before that, it was run by career officials. You know, in contrast, while it took some time for the Trump administration to kind of confirmed head of the antitrust division to show up, his principal deputy was in place by spring of 2017. And it's also taken some time for the full leadership team to get into place at the antitrust division. In fact, only this week did the final member of that team, Susan Athey, the economist, and the come join as the deputy assistant attorney general for economics. So I think the result is we haven't seen the full impact of sort of Biden administration political appointees and AAG Kanter's leadership specifically. Antitrust cases tend to move slowly, and so we really haven't seen the full life cycle of a significant case under his leadership. Now, on the rhetorical front, Kanter has come out swinging. He's criticized the consumer welfare standard. He has criticized the practice of settling merger cases, not simply behavioral remedies, which are almost universally derided, but even structural remedies. And he's repeatedly employed muscular rhetoric about not being afraid to bring difficult cases and the importance of litigating as opposed to settling cases. In terms of policy, we have seen some movement on the policy front. The most significant is likely going to be the rewriting of the merger guidelines in conjunction with the FTC. We haven't seen the new guidelines yet, but if the call for comments is indicative, I would expect a pretty dramatic change. And I hope we'll have a chance to talk a little bit about merger guidelines later in this panel. In terms of civil non-merger enforcement, there are public reports that Cantor is recused from the DOJ's most significant conduct case, which was brought by the last administration and is scheduled to go to trial in September of 2023. And we haven't seen any additional Section 2 cases brought yet. But this clearly, based on his speeches, seems to be a priority for Cantor. And I would be surprised if we didn't see at least one and maybe several before before the end of his tenure. In terms of civil merger enforcement, DOJ has been very active in bringing merger challenges. Some of these decisions were made by career officials before Cantor was confirmed. Some of the cases have been pretty aggressive. None strike me, although I'd be curious to hear Elise and Amanda's views on this, as unique to the Biden administration. The previous administration brought some pretty aggressive merger enforcement cases as well. And while I certainly wouldn't say that the same cases would have necessarily been brought by the administration, nothing strikes me as an outlier that a previous administration wouldn't have, could not have brought, at least for the DOJ. On criminal enforcement, we have seen some very aggressive actions, particularly in the labor space with prosecutions for alleged no poach agreements and wage fixing. Again, though, this is a continuation of indictments that were brought in the previous administration. You know, I think the criminal enforcement does give us an example that Jonathan Cantor is true to his word when he says he's not afraid to bring difficult cases. And perhaps the most significant is the Chickens prosecution, where there was two mistrials and Cantor proceeded with a third trial, which was highly unusual, if not unprecedented. That actually just came out with an acquittal yesterday. So we're still, you know, we'll still see whether kind of we're going to get some traction on that. I would say the one thing on the criminal side that would represent an enormous departure, and we've seen rhetoric about it, but we haven't yet seen any indictments, is a Section 2 criminal case. DOJ has repeatedly said under Cantor that it would consider bringing this case. It hasn't given a lot of guidance as to what the exact facts would be around that. And there hasn't been a Section 2 criminal prosecution sort of in the modern era of antitrust enforcement. So if such prosecution were brought, then that would be a very significant departure. It'd be a very interesting case to watch, unless I suppose you were the subject of it. And you know, we'll see. So I think significant changes on the horizon, but still yet to kind of fully come to fruition.
Thanks, David. I mean, tell us a little bit about what you're seeing in the world as it has been in the Biden administration.
Sure. So, the, you know, the perspective that I bring here is certainly that I was at the FTC for about a decade under both Republican and Democratic administrations. But most recently, the last 3 years that I was at the FTC, I was on detail to Congress. So I'm going to sort of give the backdrop of what has been going on in Congress during the Biden administration, understanding that separation of powers, we are, you know, there's certainly been a lot of coordination, and the Biden administration has weighed in, mostly in favor of things that the democratically controlled Congress has done on antitrust, some of which was also on a bipartisan basis, or most of which. So with that, I will I'll explain a little bit about what's been going on in Congress, where antitrust has had a much more prominent role than it has in the past. Typically, the antitrust subcommittee, certainly on both sides, has been a pretty sleepy committee. but not so while I was there. So I would say first, there are kind of four categories or four issue areas that Congress has been focused on when it comes to antitrust. And so that are, those are digital markets, supply chain, healthcare, and agriculture. There's also, I would say labor competition issues as well. So we'll make that five. I think the most sort of prominent area has been in digital markets, but all of these areas were highlighted as priorities in President Biden's July 2021 executive order. So in that executive order, the president it had a pretty extensive order and all geared towards promoting competition in the American economy, but all of these areas were featured prominently. So the digital markets investigation was initiated during the Trump administration, and that was a 16-month bipartisan investigation focused on Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Apple. And based on the findings of the investigation, after Biden took office, a group of Judiciary Committee members introduced several bipartisan bills, all of which were aimed at reining in the monopoly power of the largest online platforms and also revitalizing competition in digital markets. So the Senate Judiciary Committee has advanced the companions of two of those bills, the American The American Innovation and Online Choice Act, which I did not name, but I did work on, and the Open App Markets Act. And the bill sponsors are hoping for a vote this summer on both of those bills. And it is certainly plausible that that could happen and those bills could become law. So tying back to the Biden administration, the White House has endorsed the big tech legislation. And that is that came from the DOJ in the form of a letter, which is not just approved through the antitrust division, but also goes through other parts of the administration. And then also at the Department of Commerce, Secretary Raimondo also endorsed the legislation. So I think there's been a pretty strong show of support there. This, as I think, as I mentioned, the legislation is bipartisan and has a lot of support on the Republican side as well. Just briefly on healthcare, there have been hearings on, I think that both in pharma and provider consolidation have been priorities on both the Senate and the House side. There has also been legislation that has been advanced out of committee, but not enacted yet. And I'd say another topic that, not surprisingly, has received a lot of attention is the relationship between competition issues and some of the supply chain problems and fragility that we've seen, and also some of the high prices, right? High prices in particular for consumer goods. And I know on the House side, they had a hearing looking at that. And I think that's the sense, certainly from the White House, I think that, there's messaging that certainly competition issues and consolidation issues and problems and lax enforcement over the years has under enforcement and lax enforcement has contributed to many of the problems that we're seeing today in our supply chain and very high and rising prices. So for the other areas, agriculture and labor, I think we're going to talk a little bit more about labor competition issues later, but I would just also note that both of those have been explicitly identified as high priority for this administration, both again in that executive order and then by the leaders of the Chair Khan at the FTC and Assistant Attorney General Cantor at DOJ, that both with rhetoric and action, I think we've seen attention to all of the industries and issues that I mentioned.
Thanks, Amanda. And Elise, you've done some research and you've got some interesting insights into kind of the current system and where we look like we're going.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, first of all, you know, thank you so much for having me too. I think this is a really fun topic and I love a good excuse to see David and Amanda. And, you know, as I've been saying, I think it's a really interesting time in the antitrust world. I think it's a really reflective period that we're in a time where we're really reassessing our assumptions about what it is antitrust law can achieve and what it should be aiming to achieve, right? There are a lot of potential goals out there and a lot of really important sociopolitical factors and considerations. And I think we're trying to figure out the extent to which antitrust properly has a role here. And I think one of the fundamental questions that you know, implicitly raises is what is actually the capacity of antitrust law and policy to be achieving some of these goals? A lot of them, you know, are really worthy goals in their own rights. You know, for any one given area of law, there's only so much you can maximize, right? So, you know, we kind of have to figure that out and also to figure out, you know, again, like what antitrust enforcement is actually capable of. So if we start bringing antitrust cases, are they, you know, able to really achieve the goals we want them to achieve? So I think, you know, we'll get into a bit more of that a bit later on in the discussion. But I think, again, it makes this a really good opportunity to be critically reviewing what antitrust law's capacity is and to be, you know, kind of checking our existing assumptions and, you know, taking a rigorous look at, okay, you know, what's the evidence that we have? You know, again, we've been enforcing the antitrust laws for well over 100 years at this point in the U.S. So there's a lot of information and data we can draw from when we're, you know, making these important decisions as to how to keep our markets competitive and how best to serve consumers going forward. And I think as David alluded to in his discussions over at the FTC, I think we're seeing some similar themes in terms of, you know, some of these other notions that they're considering and how they might be able to affect some change and, you know, some good movement in some of these spaces. As David noted as well, I think, you know, we've started to see some initial shifts in the FTC, you know, expressing a lot of interest in some of these different areas, but not so much has yet had a chance to come to fruition. Again, you know, some of this change takes a little time and they've only had, you know, I think the new chair just passed the year mark. So I think they've been busy, right? But not a ton, again, has like been fully fleshed out and started to come to realization, especially again, as David mentioned, in terms of, you know, what cases have actually gotten to the courts and been able to be litigated. So I think what we've seen so far is a lot of expressions kind of in, you know, policy statements, you know, sometimes in statements going along with settlements, where the FTC is really explaining some of the other things that like they are looking at critically now. And I think trying to navigate the way forward on some of these. I know, you know, Chair Khan early on in her administration noted that she was really looking to create a more holistic approach to identifying harms, including recognizing that antitrust and consumer protection violations might harm workers and independent businesses as well as consumers. So, you know, that's been a little bit of a, you know, shift in their thinking. I think we've seen a lot of focus on potential labor monopsony, you know, Commissioner Slaughter, I think last summer now, you know, reiterated that she thinks antitrust law can be doing more to affect racial equity and might be able to, you know, navigate in that space as well. So we've seen a lot of kind of statements like that. And then the FTC also has been, you know, kind of changing or adopting some of their guidance. So they revoked their Section 5 statement. They also withdrew from the vertical merger guidelines last year. And I think this, again, kind of puts us in an interesting space at this point where they've taken away some guidance. They haven't put out anything new yet. I know they're actively working on it. And I think a lot of people have a lot of expectations about what that might or might not be able to do. And as David said, I think we'll get into this a little bit later. But I think it's, again, like a really interesting time. And it does kind of feel like we're on the precipice of some potentially really big shifts and are just kind of waiting to see how all of that takes shape.
Thanks, Elise. Well, the first question we're going to throw to the whole panel is, where would you put the Biden administration's efforts in the short and long term arcs of the history of U.S. antitrust and competition policy? So we'll take a couple minutes and talk about that. Elise, if you want to go first.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, I think it's an interesting time because in a lot of ways it feels like deja vu all over again. You know, for the last few decades, right, antitrust had been pretty focused on, you know, economic considerations, right? It really kind of became targeted over the last several years. And that's what the courts really look at is the consumer welfare. And that's, you know, it's kind of the lodestar, right, of antitrust analysis when courts are figuring out, okay, does this violate the antitrust laws or not? They're looking to, okay, what actually happens to consumer welfare? Are prices going up or down? Is this harming innovation? You know, is quality getting better or worse? And kind of really looking to those factors. And what we're seeing today is, you know, a bit of a resurgence and, you know, a notion that antitrust law maybe can be doing more about some of these sociopolitical goals that are, you know, again, a big part of the broader popular discussion at this point in time. And, you know, really trying to foster that. And that is something, you know, in the history of antitrust law, you know, for several decades, there were many different goals that the antitrust laws were trying to foster. And I think, you know, recognizing some of the history is important here because it informs how we got to where we have been for the last several decades. And so one thing in particular that I thought, you know, I mentioned in the discussion here is, you know, I've been working on a paper looking at income inequality or the distribution of income, because there's a ton of information there and kind of empirical work as to, you know, what's been going on for, you know, about a century now, and kind of tracking that against what has been happening in antitrust enforcement. Because for a very long time now, there's been this notion that there's been kind of an intimate relation between antitrust enforcement and the distribution of income. So as far back as 1940, the Temporary National Economic Committee identified this potentially, you know, intimate relationship between the two and, you know, really set out to explore that given some, you know, early data in terms of, you know, income inequality and what they were seeing in antitrust. And what I've been trying to do is kind of map the two trends over time to really, for the first time, explore what's actually going on there and see, you know, how well they track against one another. Because again, I think what's happening right now is, like, you know, we're reassessing what antitrust law can do. And when we do that, you know, we really need to think about what is antitrust law's capacity here. I think, you know, there's a lot of agreement across the board that individual antitrust cases will have obvious distributional effects. And I think the bigger question is whether antitrust law can or really does play any sort of more than marginal role, and can really affect change in terms of the distribution of income. And I, you know, think what the early data that I've been able to pull together so far doesn't really show that there's a strong relationship between the two, that, you know, antitrust enforcement isn't necessarily, again, on a macro level affecting distribution of income, which, you know, is maybe not surprising given, you know, how factually based individual cases are and all of those kinds of things. And again, like even in 1940, the report of the Temporary National Economic Committee noted that, you know, increasing the effectiveness of competition is not necessarily going to yield equal incomes for all. And that, you know, a considerable degree of income inequality, you know, seems consistent with a degree of competition and is probably actually an essential characteristic of a competitive economy. Right. So, again, I think it's kind of this balancing act. And, you know, I think that's what we're seeing again is, you know, antitrust law went from trying to foster several different goals, including many sociopolitical goals, kind of focused very narrowly on the economic goals for the last several decades. And now there's kind of, you know, this reassessment in terms of, okay, moving forward, are there other things antitrust law can or should be doing?
Thanks, Elise. Amanda, do you have any thoughts on where we are in the long-term arc?
Yeah, I do. So I think I'm going to talk a little bit more kind of, I think the question that Elise raised and the work that she's doing is really interesting. And I agree 100% that it is very helpful to to look to the past, to try to learn lessons from the past, to make informed decisions about the future. So I really, for that reason, like, I'm a big fan of merger retrospectives. So I really applaud her work on that. I think it is a tough, it's a tough issue, in terms of kind of when you're looking at sort of correlation. I'm not saying anything that anybody doesn't know here, but correlation versus causation, and then sort of trying to isolate the amount to which, how much antitrust enforcement or stronger antitrust enforcement might be somehow alleviating income inequality or other sociopolitical problems. My view is, certainly under current law, we should be using every tool we have available to address sociopolitical problems. We have antitrust law, and I think the rhetoric and the action that I think we've seen to date and probably will see more of is a reflection of Assistant Attorney General Cantor and Chair Kahn saying what I've heard them say all along, which is we absolutely need to be using every tool in our toolbox at the agencies to address the problems that we can. So I guess I say I certainly, I do not think that antitrust can solve every problem, but I do think that aggressive and strong antitrust enforcement and more competition will help, and will help in a significant and tangible way that is worthwhile. I don't know that affects, except for maybe at the margins in some very close cases, sort of which cases are brought versus which cases are not. So I think it will be interesting to see how the rhetoric and sort of the philosophy that Assistant Attorney General Cantor and Chair Kahn came into their roles with, how that does come into play in the policymaking and, again, like, the enforcement decisions. They're in enforcement agencies. So how much will that actually change things? I again commend them and think that they are on the right track to say we should be using every tool available to be as enforcement minded as we can to try to address some of these problems. Coming from where I came from, being on the Hill for those past 3 years, I think for more significant change that we really do need to see legislative change, that we need Congress to step in. I look forward to seeing the enforcers and the agencies to implement some of the policies that they talked about, and there's certainly a lot that they can do. So I look forward to that. I think one thing that I would like to highlight in terms of a change that, and I'll try to be brief about this, that that I think has been really positive and interesting, that I did see sort of firsthand when I went back to the agency for a few months after I was on detail, is that I think Chair Kahn and Assistant Attorney General Cantor, but I'm sort of more intimately familiar with the FTC side, has made a concerted and pretty successful effort to democratize the agency's enforcement and policy work in a way that has brought in a lot of new and important voices that have somewhat, perhaps because of resource constraints or other reasons, have not been part of the conversation. So I think that has been a real change and I think an improvement to have not just kind of the narrow antitrust bar or antitrust lawyers and their clients weighing in on policy, but opening that up to more to the public and to community groups and small businesses and other types of civil society groups who can provide a very different but important perspective.
Thanks, Amanda. David, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, and I'll try to be brief, but I mean, I think at least rhetorically, right? Because we're still somewhat early. We haven't seen the full fruits, but at least rhetorically on the short-term arc, I think we're seeing kind of the Biden administration enforcers, again, rhetorically reject a 40-year bipartisan consensus around antitrust and specifically kind of the consumer welfare and the role that the economics plays in that. And, you know, there's kind of a high degree of skepticism of economic analysis and the idea of efficiency as an overriding goal of antitrust. You know, I think a lot of skepticism of corporate power and bigness in general. And to be fair and to be clear, this is not, say it's a partisan rejection of it, because you certainly see this from you know, there seems to be a kind of realignment happening, you know, across both parties. You know, I see a lot of skepticism of kind of the value of mergers and acquisitions. Now, in the broad arc, in the long term arc, in many ways, this is a return to older approaches to antitrust. One concern I have is sort of what replaces that consensus, because, you know, I think there's some significant merit to the critiques that were laid against kind of the antitrust of the 50s, of the 60s, of the 70s. That it was vague and unprincipled, and so I think what we haven't quite seen yet is assuming that the actions live up to the rhetoric and assuming that their success is kind of what comes next. We have hints, you know, we talk about competitive process and market structure as opposed to consumer welfare. Kind of talk about dispersion of power or access to markets or kind of anti-concentration or even resiliency kind of in response to efficiency. You know, hear a lot of talk about kind of the importance of bright line rules and structural presumptions and structural separations as opposed to kind of a rule of reason analysis that sort of kind of specifically looks at individual practices and mergers, but I think there's still a lot of details that need to be filled in before we kind of understand exactly what the new world will look like.
Thanks, David. And kind of related to that, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of discussion about the consumer welfare standard and whether or not it is the kind of correct policy goal or whether there should be other policy goals. What are your reactions? We'll start with you, Amanda, to expanding antitrust purpose to things beyond kind of the pure consumer welfare standard that has been kind of the touchstone for the last 3 or 4 decades.
So I think you touched on this a little bit before, but I think this is a good question, and this is an area that I sort of welcome the opportunity to. What I think is an area that merits some sort of clarification. In my experience, people are often talking past each other when they debate whether antitrust law should be limited to the consumer welfare standard or broader. So I think it's really important to sort of start with a shared sense of defined terms. And you know, at least for the specific conversation, because it's just consumer welfare. I have, generally I've seen it be used in 2 different ways, often without the speaker maybe explaining that, just kind of assuming that everyone, you know, knows is using the same definition. So, you know, first, I think there's a broader view, which is kind of prevalent among most members of the antitrust bar, and it's actually fairly conventional. It was always my understanding of what I was supposed to be applying as a staff attorney looking at merger investigations. And that definition definitely encompasses non-price harms to consumers, like decreased quality. It encompasses harm to workers and sellers of goods or services, for example, in monopsony cases. So so that is one definition that I think is at least among the antitrust bar and practitioners and the agencies, actually not very controversial. The other view that I think I've heard maybe more on the Hill or maybe in academic circles is more narrow, suggesting that the consumer welfare standard is only concerned with price effects on consumers. Unfortunately, some court decisions have also kind of articulated it that way, not been friendly, or let's say have been even hostile to the broader view, which again, I think among antitrust bar is fairly conventional. And going back to the point about sort of what is the proper role of antitrust law, I do think that consolidation and anti-competitive conduct has exacerbated and does exacerbate many social ills on a broad scale. So, for example, hospital merger consolidation has, I don't have sort of the empirical work in front of me, but I think that I know that there is empirical work that there has been harms to patients and quality based on consolidation. So, and access to healthcare and things like that. So I guess I'll just kind of wrap it up that, in my view, stronger antitrust enforcement and policies that result in more competition can absolutely help alleviate some of these sociopolitical harms. And I don't think antitrust can solve every problem, but I do think it is an important tool in the toolbox, and it shouldn't, you should take it out and use it.
Thanks, Amanda. David, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so I mean, I'll say, first of all, I agree with Amanda that I think, at least with the antitrust bar, consumer welfare has been understood to fairly broad. It goes well beyond on price harms. The kind of the econometricization of antitrust enforcement, and price is a very easy thing to measure. I think often channels litigation and disputes into price and price effects. And that's obviously an important part of competition. But I agree that anyone who's saying that it's just about price and price effects, or just prices on end consumers as opposed to other people kind of in that vertical chain, are misstating it. I'll be brief because I know we're running short on time, but I think, vagueness historically has been a problem with the antitrust laws. In 1937, Robert Jackson, who went on to be Justice Jackson, but he was actually the head of the antitrust division at that point in time, he said, for 40 years, administrations have alternated between the policy of being aggressively vague and passively vague when it came to antitrust enforcement. And Justice Stewart said in 1966, about 30 years later, in his dissent in Vaughn's Grocery, that is, so the sole consistency that I can find in litigation under Section 7 is that the government always wins. And so the consumer welfare standard and sort of the primacy that has taken in antitrust analysis, which coincides with about 10 years after Vaughn's Grocery, was really a way of supplying a kind of coherent, principled method to answer tough questions. And I'll just give you one example that Einar Elhag had in a relatively recent sort of popular piece, where he said, if you have a merger, if there's a 10 firm market and two of those firms merge, so it takes it from 10 to 9, but the merged firm is a more efficient and better competitor with the remaining 8 firms in the market, is that a decrease in competition because it's one fewer competitors, or is that an increase in competition because it supplies more vigorous competition? And the consumer welfare standard is a way to answer that question and say, well, that's not a decrease. That's not a lessening of competition. That's not something that we should prohibit under the antitrust laws. That's pro-competitive. That makes the market better and more efficient. And I really worried if we kind of wholesale reject consumer welfare, that we lose that coherence and we lose, you know, we lose that principled approach. And I have many more things that I could say on this, but in the interest of time, I'll stop there.
David, I'm going to turn to you quickly and just ask, I know you were just at DOJ in the antitrust division and some of the senior leadership, and just talk for a minute about some of the challenges that the Biden DOJ is going to face in achieving their policy agenda.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think there's several. I think the first is just kind of institutional inertia. You know, running a federal agency is challenging under any circumstance, and trying to make changes, even changes of the margins, is difficult. It's like steering a battleship. And that's just human nature. And if you kind of take the rhetoric from Chair Khan and from AAG Cantor seriously, and I think you should, then keeping with the nautical imagery, what they're trying to do is not kind of adjust court 10 degrees port, but to really kind of fundamentally change the direction of the ship. And that's just a very challenging thing to do. There's also then resource constraints. I mentioned how this is a very muscular rhetoric about not settling cases, but litigating them. Well, it takes a lot of effort to staff cases just for investigation. It takes even more to litigate them. And so you start running into the problems. You could only, there's only so many cases that the FTC, the Antitrust Division, can litigate at any one point in time. And so you really do have to make kind of tough choices on the margins. In every case you choose to litigate, rather than accept a settlement, even if the settlement isn't ideal, that's taking away resources from another case that might be more challenging. And then I think the final sort of challenge is going to be the federal judiciary, because you have 40 years of case law that embodies a certain view of antitrust. And the Biden administration sort of enforcers are very critical of that view, but at least for agency-driven change, and we'll set kind of congressional changes aside, for agency-driven change, you can't fundamentally make those changes without persuading a federal judge and federal courts, and doing that while you, as the agency, bear the burden of proof. We'll see. It's a lot of intelligent, talented people over there, and so I certainly wouldn't rule that out. But it's going to be tough.
Thanks, David. Elise, talk a little bit about the challenges the FTC is going to be facing.
Yeah. I think, a lot of the same ones that David mentioned. Again, institutional inertia is a very real thing, right? It's, a big agency has been doing what it's been doing for a long time. And that's always going to be, difficult when you've got a lot of different motivating factors and different folks with different perspectives at the agencies. One thing in particular I wanted to add on, kind of picking up on the point about the federal judiciary, is, when the FTC and DOJ are thinking about, how they're going to craft the new merger guidelines and what those are going to look like, I think there's a lot of pressure on the chair and on AAG Cantor, right, to really be reshaping merger enforcement. But at the same time, what has made the merger guidelines so effective and so persuasive in court is that they've stayed relatively the same, and that FTC and DOJ have been very clear that these guidelines have been reflecting their long-term practices, right? They've largely been retrospective as opposed to, looking forward. So they've been telling the courts, this is what we've been doing for a long time, this is what we're seeing, and have very thought out reasons as to, okay, for the last several years, we've been seeing this, and this is how we've been updating, for example, consent decrees, what we look for in divestitures. And so, then over time, incorporating those changes to, again, like really reflect current agency practice. And I think there's going to be a bit of a tension for them moving forward in terms of, if they want to start reshaping mergers and how they're reviewing them, how they kind of walk that line with also, maintaining merger guidelines that, courts are going to be comfortable relying on and giving deference to.
I just add just real quick, Jonathan, is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I think that I think that is a really interesting point, and I will be interested to see how courts do, what kind of deference they do give to any new guidelines that are issued by the agency or other guidance documents. I do think that there is a big benefit to the agency being transparent about the fact that, look, we are new leadership here. We're going to be doing things differently. So while I know there's been some criticism about rescinding the guidelines and there's, you know, there is a risk that new guidelines won't have sort of the force of law that the longstanding guidelines that have been in place have generally enjoyed by the courts. There is, there's a transparency there that is providing, I think, valuable information to industry and marketplace participants who are considering mergers that, look, that's the old approach. Like, we are not taking that approach anymore. And, you know, I give the agency credit for that. I think it's important that people, that the guidelines match the approach that the agency is going to take.
Thanks, Amanda. So one interesting question that I've had in thinking about this topic is, assume that we have had the standards wrong and that the new kind of, assume that we have had some sort of change in paradigm, which good, bad, or indifferent. If we realize that there are mergers that we've approved and there are organizations and companies that exist now that maybe we don't think are benefiting consumers or whoever ought to be benefited, what is the way that you deal with kind of unwinding those things, or how do you kind of control Z the situation and not basically just reward all the incumbent companies that have managed to get by in the old system, and now you're punishing the future mergers that are coming forward? So Elise, do you want to take that question first?
Sure. I'll take a stab at it. And I'm sure Amanda and David will have many things to add and many corrections to make. But I think it's a great question. I think that's really where the rub is today, right? Is, okay, but how do we navigate a viable path forward? And I think some of that, again, kind of starts with taking stock of, you know, what we've seen, not just in the short term, but, you know, the longer term trajectory of antitrust law, and really, you know, looking at the cases and what the agencies have been bringing and how we've been doing things. And again, making sure that we're assessing what antitrust capacity is. Again, you know, we want to make sure we're using all the tools in our toolkit, but we also want to make sure we're properly identifying them and using them the way that we're supposed to, so that, again, we're actually getting what we want to out of the tools, and we're not, you know, creating chaos where we're trying to create, you know, competition. And I think, you know, kind of to your point about how do we, you know, not just, you know, how do we, you know, viably on the way forward, you know, continue to help out, you know, smaller businesses and things. I think some of this is difficult because a lot of times with increasing regulatory costs and regulatory hurdles, what you see is, like, you know, powerful incumbents are a little bit better, you know, maybe a lot better situated to be navigating that because they have all these sorts of resources. So again, I think it's really important to be cognizant of both, you know, the effects we want to achieve and any potentially unintended effects of the different regulations, so that we're not, you know, pricing smaller competitors out of the market because we're raising the cost of, you know, all mergers, even ones that would be good for smaller competitors. And so that leaves us with only, you know, larger mergers with incumbents who are powerful and, like, have, you know, money to throw at lawyers to be, you know, moving things forward. This hour is flying by and we're kind of getting close to the end. So I want to make sure David and Amanda have a chance to weigh in here as well.
Yeah. Go ahead, David.
I mean, you know, one tool they have, and it's a hard tool to use, but if you want to unwind deals, I mean, you can bring Section 2 or even Section 7 cases after the fact. There's nothing that stops. Maybe if there was a consent decree, that'd be a different story. But if the deal just went through, and that's exactly what you know, what the FTC is doing with their large, you know, Section 2 case that came in December of 2020, is trying to unwind kind of long since closed deals. The longer it goes, the more challenging it is because it's an equitable remedy. And at some point, I think federal courts say, well, you know, this happened 10 years ago, you know, I'm not gonna just give you that remedy now. You know, I think on a going forward basis, you know, you could imagine sort of, it'd probably have to be legislative, but you could imagine tweaks where you, you know, if a company, you know, met certain criteria, maybe of size in a given market, you know, maybe kind of flip the presumption, or the burden of proof. And so that might solve, you know, by not creating shackles on smaller companies that kind of need to get up to scale to compete. But letting larger companies that might already have say 50% market share, making it a lot harder for them to kind of acquire companies that go, you know, above that 50% market share, but still giving them an out if there actually is a compelling sort of pro-competitive reason for the deal, but putting the burden on them to do that. I mean, this is a thought experiment in my mind. I'm not endorsing that, just so we're clear. I think those are kind of options.
Well, and Amanda's on the plaintiff side now in her private practice, so she might want to endorse that position. Amanda, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, not just among the plaintiffs bar, you know, so you say in terms of merger cases, there are actually very few private antitrust enforcement challenges to mergers, even though that is, you know, that is contemplated within the statute. I think that burden shifting is something that there's a lot of, well, at least on the Judiciary Committee, I saw, you know, there is some bipartisan support for that in our digital markets investigation. That was one of the recommendations that we included in the report. And that was also in the Third Way report, which was authored by or put out by ranking member Buck and joined by a few other Republican judiciary members. So I think that is something that could be a good path forward in terms of legislation. With respect to kind of increasing costs for some firms, you know, if you sort of raise the cost of doing mergers, Calera, which was the antitrust reform bill, introduced by Senator Klobuchar, that actually, I think, has different standards for sort of larger mergers. And so that, you know, that's one way to address it, is you have kind of tailored standards based on the size of the merger. One thing that I found, and then I guess just real quick on the House side, and there's a Senate companion for a merger bill that would be focused specifically on the covered platforms and kind of like the big tech companies, which is where there's been a lot of criticism about where the agencies have gotten it wrong. I think just something that's interesting is on the one hand, there's often, they say there's kind of this messaging that we shouldn't have sort of some broad, big merger bill that adds a lot of cost to doing mergers. But then I often see when we put forward kind of a tailored, more specific, narrowly targeted merger bill, the other side, or there's a lot of critiques that come out and say, oh, that's not right. We can't have one rule for one group of merging parties and then, you know, another for others. And often I think that criticism is just hard to take because it almost seems like these people are just saying, we don't want any changes. We don't want any merger reform, if it's specific, the critique is it's not general. We need economy-wide rules. And then if it's economy-wide, it's economy-wide and there's some, you know, there's something wrong with that. So that's just to share some experience and what I saw.
Thanks, Amanda. Well, we've got time to take one question that we received from the audience, and I'll just take all of your thoughts on it. We had a question asking, if we got rid of the consumer standard, would the set asides or goals for disadvantaged businesses from governments and from larger corporations be subject to scrutiny as economically discriminatory against small business competitors who are not disadvantaged? So I will take that. We'll go start with Elise, and then Amanda, as the plaintiff's lawyer representative on the panel, we'll let you go next, and then David.
Yeah, sorry. So I'm just trying to pull up that question again here. So I think what I understood was, you know, if we're abandoning the consumer welfare standard for disadvantaged business I think it's gone now. So some of that I think is part of what David was alluding to in terms of, you know, how do we navigate a path forward if we're abandoning the consumer welfare standard, and, you know, what does the world look like, and how do the decision makers, be it, you know, the courts or the agencies, define or decide what's legal and what's not. I think, you know, today one of the, you know, axiomatic things within antitrust law, right, is that, you know, it's there to protect consumers, not competitors. And so what happens to competitors, you know, is certainly something the courts consider. But, you know, when you think about competition, you know, a firm can do something and compete successfully on the merits, that means a competitor loses out. So they're losing sales. So if you're just looking at what happens to competitors, that's not necessarily a good proxy for competition, because, you know, consumers might be better off with the lower prices. And if, you know, a less efficient competitor can't, you know, keep up with that, that's, you know, it's good for consumers. It's not good for that competitor. And I think that's in a lot of the earlier case law within antitrust we saw was kind of the struggle, right? Was, you know, of course, we're looking at what happened to competitors and trying to protect small competitors that often put them at odds with what was happening to consumers. And so you see in some older case law, you know, the courts acknowledging that, you know, well, we're going to protect these smaller competitors and prices might be higher as a result, but, you know, that's the line they were comfortable taking at that time. That's not really a line that the courts are comfortable taking today, or have been, you know, over the last several years, several decades at this point, during which, as David noted again, you know, we had a bipartisan consensus around the consumer welfare standard. So again, I think you'd end up seeing a lot of confusion again moving forward.
Amanda.
I don't think there is this stark choice between we either, you know, that we're going to abandon the consumer welfare standard and the sky is going to fall and no one's going to know who can merge and who can't merge and what's legal and what's illegal. You know, first of all, the agencies can't do that unilaterally. As David mentioned earlier, they have to prove to a court that a merger is illegal or that conduct is illegal under, you know, the Sherman Act. What I see is I think Chair Kahn and Assistant Attorney General Cantor are saying is not like, I guess, and I think Chair Kahn has even used these words, it's about a more holistic view of what are the effects of the merger. And I think there is a lot of consensus that the bar has been too high to prove that a merger is illegal, and that the courts have been reluctant to recognize harms that are real. And so that is why you do have a lot of consensus in Congress right now that something is very wrong and very broken with the way that we have been doing things. And why there is, you know, Senator Lee, Mike Lee has an antitrust reform bill. So you're seeing it, you know, from all sides that certainly on the Hill that something is wrong here. I know, yes, we've been doing it this way for the past, you know, 30 to 40 years, but we don't like where we are. So we've been doing something wrong. So we have to, not we have to, but we want to, from a policy perspective, as Congress, we want to change what we're doing here. And we want to give courts, you know, new directions, sort of a course correction. Now that can be, you know, that can be a big course correction, or that can be more, you know, smaller, and kind of be that more holistic view versus some type of, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of thing. So I'll leave it at that.
No, that makes sense. Yeah. David, I'll give you the last word.
Sure. So, I think I echo a lot of what Elise said, which is, I think there's real danger of kind of what comes next. Although I take Amanda's point that, you know, that's not something that can be unilaterally done by the agencies, and maybe it will be, you know, an incremental change and kind of adding some holistic kind of expansion of, although I think kind of the rule of reason approach is pretty holistic. So I'm not really sure how we do that without a change. To get like very doctrinal to this question was asked is whether set asides for disadvantaged businesses by governments should be subject to scrutiny. And the answer is no, absolutely not, because the antitrust laws don't apply to governments. And that's a very well-established doctrine. On terms of large corporations, Yeah, it's an interesting thought experiment. And you know, maybe we'll be litigating that in 10 to 15 years from now. So we'll find out. Thanks everyone.
Thank you all so much. And panelists, really appreciate your time. Thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this event. I know that we didn't get to everyone's questions and we didn't get to all the questions that we as the moderator and panelists had hoped to get to, but this just gives us more things to talk about in the future. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. And I'll reiterate your thanks to the rest of the panelists as well. And thank you to our audience for tuning in to today's virtual event. You can check out our website, fedtalk.org, or follow us on all the major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.